560 KBLU. Russ Clark with you. Veronica's with me, and
good
her
morning.
Job is to tell you exactly where we are. I get it wrong.
Yes, sometimes.
Where are we?
We are at Yuma Proving Ground in Yuma, Arizona.
Military base.
Yes.
Installation.
We're the fourth largest one in the
country. Yeah, I knew she knew. And there's going to be an event here Saturday. And we want everyone to come.
It's open to anniversary?
76, YPG 2020. Yeah. YPG 2020.
And that's Ross Gwynn. And good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, and it's good to meet you.
And of course, you're not new to Yuma.
No, I've been here
a little
while.
Generationally.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I'm the sixth generation.
Sixth generation.
Yeah.
And we found you out here in the middle of Yuma Proving Ground.
Yep.
Instead of out on an agricultural field. Like, how come you're not on a tractor?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like a family thing, right?
Yeah, that was my dad's doing. He I started out in agriculture at the University of Arizona, and he said, don't do that just because I did.
Really?
So I got lucky. I had a cousin that was an engineer, and he said, yeah, I think you'd like it. So.
And so you got into engineering in college?
Yeah, I did. I actually... I probably shouldn't say this on the radio, but I switched my major five times.
We can cut it later.
We're live.
Okay. So, yeah, I started out in agriculture, went into civil engineering, and then through a handful of different switches and majors, I ended up in out here at YPG as a summer hire. And they said, hey, you know, civil engineers make the targets and mechanical engineers make the weapons. So they made me switch. Yeah, they made me switch. But it was a good deal. They paid for school. I got a great opportunity out of it.
I know people have changed many more than five times. So
yeah,
we've all done it.
Yep.
It's okay. You can say that.
All right. That's good. I'm in good company.
So now you're an engineer. You work at, how long have you been at Yuma Proving Grounds?
I've been here for 15 years. I'm working on 16 right
okay,
now.
Okay,
yeah.
15. So you like it.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Yeah.
And you work on the aviation side of things.
Yeah, that's correct.
Are you a pilot?
Negative. Nope. I'm not a pilot.
What?
No. So I'm not a pilot at all, but I work alongside them. Some great pilots, too. Uh-huh. Yeah.
No desire, obviously, because you would have already done it.
That's right. You know, honestly, I stumbled into the job like I told you. So I think anybody that's going to be a pilot knows it from a young age. I'm trying to instill that in my son now. Yeah.
Oh, really? You'd like for him to be a pilot?
I think it'd be great. I think it's a great profession, honorable profession. Yeah. He'd be.
It's a hobby, too.
Yeah.
You know?
My cousin actually flies planes. Yeah. I'm around pilots. Yeah.
Okay. I'll say you're around a lot of them.
Right. Right.
You know, Yuma has a lot of private pilots over there. But in the aviation systems, you do the testing. Now, that's got to be more exciting than just, you know, shooting howitzers.
That is a fact.
You know, I feel bad for those guys. They have to stay on the ground.
Yeah, Kermit.
Kermit,
it's the same thing every day. It goes up, it comes down. You know, but in our group, it's pretty broad-based mission area. So I've got... aviation systems, so think weapons integration, any sort of weapons employment on a rotary wing or unmanned aircraft.
When you say weapons integration, you're integrating with
2.75-inch rockets, Hellfire missiles, the new joint air-to-ground missile, 30-millimeter gun on the Apache helicopter. So anything that is airborne munition or weapon system that goes
any projectile comes out of an airplane.
That's a
rotary helicopter, whatever it is.
For the Army.
And drones?
Yeah, same thing. Yep, unmanned aircraft systems. Our primary mission is being able to integrate and test the performance of weapon systems off of unmanned or manned aircraft systems.
Okay.
And then that's just one branch. There's really three other branches. One's electronic warfare, which is.
I want to get into that too, because that's.
I'll probably stop you at some point on that.
But no, I think the electronic part is kind of exciting in that. We hear about it, you know, that there's electronic complications or something. Somebody's done something to us. But I don't think there's a real understanding of what electronic warfare is.
Yeah, so...
Go ahead and get into it. We've been talking about blowing things up all day.
I'll dance on the surface of that a little bit. But bottom line is that, you know, that mission derived from improvised explosive devices. When we went into Iraq... we knew the threat existed, that there was roadside bombs, and they were initiating them through
like
radio frequency training.
Garage door opener type technology, nothing much more. You know?
Exactly right. So that's how the mission started, was preventing that, using radio frequency energy to prevent that from happening. And it's evolved. It's evolved to using it in all kinds of different ways to really posture our soldiers to have overmatch against adversaries in some theater. So.
There's always been that kind of jamming or misdirecting, you know, I mean, since radar started or whatever.
That's correct, yeah.
All of that stuff has been...
And it's evolved a lot. I won't get into the details. I really can't.
I mean, nobody cares.
No, I can't get into the details, but it has evolved a lot. It's pretty impressive. You know, that's one branch that highly technical. All of my branches are technical, but that branch...
Well, that's cutting edge. I mean, that's got to be new every day, I would think.
And it's a newer mission. You know, when we went to Iraq, that was something the Army focused. That was a priority. Let's stand this up. Let's, you know, people are dying, and that's right. The number one priority at the time. So.
But on the electronic warfare, and I just, you know, specifics by any means, but are we talking about just through aircraft or we...
Air ground-based systems.
Air ground-based systems.
Yeah, so essentially what's happening is it started out with very specific systems that were designed to do that, and now it's evolved into every single piece of equipment that goes into the field, whether it's a ground combat asset like a vehicle or it's an aircraft, they're all going to have some sort of capability that can help them provide overmatch from an electronic warfare standpoint.
And, of course, anytime you develop something to counteract, then you've got to protect the protection so that you don't get interacted.
That's a fact.
So it's a
cat and mouse.
It all builds on top of each other. Every time you develop something that's going to give you an advantage, you want to make sure that that advantage isn't used against you.
That's right. Yeah, it's a cat and mouse game for sure. And it's very strategic. We're thinking about, you know, you talked about Army modernization,
right?
And where the Army's headed, and that's a level above that concerns all four services. So really, that branch is at the DoD level. Working with the electronic warfare spectrum operations cross-functional team, kind of like the Army's doing for modernization.
What about artificial intelligence? We get that involved yet?
That's happening. We have a big demonstration coming up at the end of this fiscal year really is the Army Futures Command's opportunity to demonstrate everything associated with artificial intelligence. And it's going to happen here.
So much information now.
Yeah.
I mean, information comes in from so fast. To be able to decipher it, we need, you know, I would assume you need programming.
Big data analytics, yeah. So that's a big thing in the Army. That's a big initiative in the Army is big data analytics. So how do you go and take an unmanned aircraft system, for instance, that has, you know, 100 of them in the sky at the same time, and they're working by themselves?
But they work in conjunction with each other.
Correct. They're communicating. So essentially what we have to think about
is
engineers. Right. Right. They swarm. They call them swarms.
I read...
You're read up. It's good. So when you're talking about that, you're talking about inter-element communication and intra-element communication, right, inside and outside of that swarm. You really have to collect all that data of what sensors are on board that are sensing things and making decisions based on that. And you have to evaluate or identify what are the performance errors associated with the decisions that swarm is making all by itself. You know, it's all autonomous. There's machine learning. There's some impressive capabilities that we're starting to posture, making sure we have the instrumentation and all the equipment on our side to test it properly and that we're smart on that.
Have you heard of that kind of technology before?
Yeah.
Veronica, I know you read. I know you keep up with that.
Intelligence is like...
It scares you, right?
I have my eye on.
but some of that swarming technology, they're not all being controlled from the same source. They're all independently controlled, but they work with each other.
There's a handful of ways that they go about it, but yeah, there's sometimes a master node, and all of them are taking direction based on that master node, and they're communicating to a single node. Sometimes they're all intercommunication between them, all of them amongst them. So we have to be able to say what is this one sensing all by itself, this one of 100, and what's this one sensing all by itself with its different sensor, and why are they making decisions the way they are?
Are we going to see any of that Saturday, Will? Do you know?
So there will be some unmanned aircraft on display.
Okay.
Yeah, they're going to have some static displays.
I want
to show that.
Swarm.
Yeah, well, that will not be on display. So that stuff is real. You know, we can bring that around a general population.
But a lot of that has been commercial too, where, you know, they take that technology for fireworks type displays for lights in the sky, where you'll see a few hundred drones go up in the air to make just different
pictures,
color displays and pictures. And stuff, and it's amazing.
Yeah, it is phenomenal, and that's funny you bring that up, that, you know, in the commercial sector, there's a lot of things that we have to think about as military that cannot be used against us, right?
Right.
So as a drone gets sold on Amazon, the adversary sees that as an opportunity, right? So we have to be thinking ahead. We're always 5-10 years ahead of what's going to come out in the commercial market. What do we have to
know?
Have
what to do with it all yet. Really, the commercialization is much ahead of the regulation.
Yeah, so the military, you know, historically the military drives technology, right? Now we're seeing industry, the Silicon Valley, all that stuff, start to drive technologies.
Right.
But that's where we as the military are teaming. We're teaming with industry, making sure that we're, one, giving them a place to go and test. We have restricted airspace, and we enable customers to come out and test these things that you couldn't go fly over a neighborhood and test it as a company because there's risk associated with it. So there's a lot of teaming with academia, industry, to make sure the military is postured as those technologies emerge that we figure out military applications.
So if you read something on the internet about a new technology, you know it's coming here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, essentially, we're usually ahead of it. Like, we know what's coming down.
You may know it before the article.
Well, we understand, yes, exactly. We understand what the current technologies are, where it's headed, and we can get ahead of that. And that's all teaming with industry and where the development's heading. We're funding that as a Department of Defense. We fund research dollars to go look at that stuff. So we're usually pretty tied in with where things are headed. And at YPG, we know, hey, these are the training that we have to send people to. This is the type of instrumentation we have to have to be postured to test that in the future. So,
and a lot of this stuff is still future. You deal with future.
Yeah. Very much so. We're pretty strategic at this point. Army Futures Command stands up the first command in, I don't know, over 50 years.
A lot of testing goes on out here. I mean, they're testing World War, still old ammunition. They test a lot of current.
Yeah. And some of the modernization is looking at how do we take the current systems and push them to the limits. You know, we don't want to buy all brand new everything if we don't have to. So we are looking at that, and the Army's being fiscally responsible.
So the government?
Yeah, we are. And we are. We're leaning forward.
Ross, they pay you to say that.
You'd be surprised.
That's good. Now, as far as munitions, when you're actually firing away from the electronics, which I'd love to know more, but I know
we've only covered two branches so far.
You're only going to tell me very limited.
Right. I am.
I kind of get that.
Yeah. Yes, there are two other branches. One is sensors, test branch, and that's anything that can sense in the battle space better than a soldier's, than a human can sense.
What do you want to sense?
So, and everything from, high altitude, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance sensors, day TV cameras, infrared cameras, radar systems.
But what are they looking for when they sense? When you say sense, you sense movement or sense radioactivity?
Movement, radioactivity, you name it. So if I'm interested in a specific area and it's rural and I see any movement, that's a potential target of interest, right? Depending on where I'm at in the world.
Okay.
So they can do that through seismic sensors in the ground, acoustic sensors in the ground. We can have acoustic sensors that can detect gunshots,
right.
Figure out point of origin so that we can respond to that
commercial. You're seeing cities buy stuff like that. Right?
Yeah. I mean, definitely you're hearing community leaders talking more about, hey, these are the types of things that we're thinking about. As you guys talk about this at the military and you're talking about overseas threats, what do we need to worry about? But I believe that, we've got a good grip on that and that we understand what technologies are available now, what the threats really are. So,
well, I know the Border Patrol works on, sensors are huge to them.
Yeah.
And this new wall that's going in is integrated with sensors.
That's a fact. And our sensors group actually did a whole bunch of developmental work for the past 15 years. And they actually go overseas and help employ some of those types of technologies and some of our coalition partners' borders. So they do a lot of that virtual fence technology, stuff in the ground surveillance radars, camera systems, all that stuff.
But once you put all those sensors out there, again you're going to get so much information if you're talking a 700-mile wall.
Yeah, well, with regard to all the data coming back, that's where you have to have a systems engineer come up and figure out how do we populate all that data to a human that it makes sense, right? And so if I'm getting detections off ground sensors and air sensors, it's all coming back to a common operational picture, they call it, which is essentially like a tablet screen, and you can kind of make decisions on, I want to point a camera over here because this sensor detected.
When I was going to get to that, I mean, the sensors generally are accompanied with some kind of visual confirmation.
That's correct, yeah.
Whether that's a drone or a land-based camera or something.
Yeah, that's essentially that branch's job, is detect something of military interest, or in the case of Border Patrol, different rules of engagement, but detect something of military interest, classify it. Is it wheels or tracked vehicle? That'd give you an idea if it's potentially
or
a threat.
10-point buck.
Right, or 10-point buck. Recognize it and eventually identify it, as a T-72 Russian tank or whatever it might be. So,
Yeah. And now sensors are also used for specific, I mean, I've heard of them before, being designed for specific equipment, like a tank.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a sensor that will just detect a tank, maybe hooked to some kind of anti-tank device.
Yeah, so you'd be blown away at all the different technologies that they use, and they bring them all together, and they put them on a vehicle or put them on an aircraft, and some are designed to detect hostile fire, some are designed to detect personnel movements, vehicle movements, all that stuff. So.
And you work on that also, the sensors.
Yeah, so that's one of the branches.
What's the other branch?
The last branch is air delivery, so parachute systems, personnel, cargo parachute systems, guided and unguided parachute systems.
I've been out here for parachute drops before, which kind of amazed me.
Yeah.
That they're sophisticated themselves. I mean, they're like their own vehicle.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. So we're seeing, parachute systems get dumped out 25 kilometers or 25,000 feet high, 30 kilometers off of the drop zone, and steering themselves within 50 meters of a soldier that needs it. So pretty cool technology being employed right now in that area. So.
And some of those. And some of those will handle vehicles. I mean, parachutes. So you'll parachute out a vehicle.
Yeah.
Or supplies of all sizes.
Yeah. This week right now we're actually we have some 92 Romeo test paratrooper riggers that exist.
92 Romeo.
So that's a MOS in the military. That's a specific occupation in the military.
Right.
And so they are responsible for figuring out how do we rig up a joint light tactical vehicle. And they've got one right now at the rigging shed. They're putting honeycomb to dampen the forces when it actually hits the ground.
Right.
They're figuring out where to tie the parachutes up, and they're actually doing that to certify that vehicle to get pushed out of an aircraft for our soldiers when they need
it. And then they could push it out as high as they want to, and you've got deployment systems that will take it.
Yeah, so joint precision. Yeah.
And those aren't necessarily have any kind of power behind them. They're not motorized.
No, so it's 100% under parachute, so you're looking at glide slopes and how far you can get based on that parachute's design.
But then you also have motor power parachutes too.
Yeah, that's correct. So right, typically the air delivery branch that we have right now is looking at technologies both GPS guided, non-GPS guided, to be able to look at the surface of the ground, figure out it has mapping software loaded, and it identifies exactly where it's at and where it needs to land just based on visual pictures of the ground. So it's not even GPS.
And some of that has been open to look at. I see familiar equipment. I mean, Rotex engines or something. You're not redeveloping new engines. I mean, you're just taking stuff off the shelf.
So there is definitely redesign and development of new parachutes when they're needed. So as we talk about the Air Force trying to get higher and further away from the fight to protect our assets, there's new systems. They're going to 60,000 to 80,000 pound. Parachutes have to be able to withstand those forces of something that big.
80,000 pounds?
That's where we're headed right now.
Oh,
so we're talking 60,000, we're talking heavy, heavy, heavy vehicles and systems of the future that we're going to have to be able to drop. And so they're redesigning new parachutes specifically for that mission.
And they drop parachutes out here too, I know.
Yeah, all the time. And personnel parachutes. We've got the test paratrooper riggers I talked about. Those are really the only soldiers that we have directly in the test mission at YPG that they're jumping the first parachutes. They're the first ones out of that aircraft. After, of course, we dropped a bunch of mannequins. But they're the first ones out. So they're
nice of you.
Yeah.
I mean, they go ahead and test it first.
Yeah, yeah. Great group of guys. Very professional.
But there's been guys that have jumped out of planes at 30,000 feet and so. I mean, I don't know if you're doing that up there, right?
Say that one more time, I'm sorry.
To come out at 30,000 feet?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, really? You'll do that here?
Maybe. Yeah, that happens. Like, and we also do work with NASA.
They're wearing just short of spacesuits coming out.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty neat stuff. They have oxygen systems in their masks so that they have to be able to breathe above 12,500 feet. Pretty cool capabilities that they're doing, so we can come in under the cloak of darkness and at all altitudes and be where
so
we need
you
to
get,
be.
No wonder you like it out here.
You love it.
You get to handle all that, plus any ordinances that come off of the aircraft, too.
That's correct.
We're talking Hellfire missiles and all that.
Yep.
And they're constantly updating missiles.
Yeah. Like right now, we have the joint air-to-ground missile that's being developed. We're talking about shooting vehicles at high speeds, mid-clip. We've got a targets group that literally put a remote kit in the vehicle, made it drive itself down the road at high speeds, and that missile's designed.
Couldn't get away.
Actually put it right through the door.
Right.
So pretty cool capabilities we're seeing.
Well, and... It's what keeps the soldier safe, and I know you have that in mind. I think everybody else out here does, too.
No, there's a culture out here that really everybody's here for something, a moral benefit bigger than a paycheck or anything else. Everybody's here to do this fun job, and it's like being it's like large version of G.I. Joe's when you're a kid. So every day's different.
But your family's not disappointed that you didn't go into agriculture?
No, not at all. Not at all. I have an awesome family at home. I have a wife that's super independent. I think we all do, realistically.
But you take pride in your heritage.
I do. I love it. Yeah, I have a deep pride in my heritage, deep pride in the history of YPG and all of it. Everything associated with
heritage itself.
Yeah, yeah.
It really does.
76
as well as Yuma.
Yep. I've got a lot of pride in Yuma in general. So.
Well, we appreciate all you do for the country too, Ross. So.
I'm having fun. our soldiers are the ones doing the tough job. We're just trying to help.
Well, I'm glad you're having fun. Ross, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Hey,
you're listening to AM 560 KBLU. Russ Clark, and we'll be back after this. AM 560 KBLU. Russ Clark back with you. Veronica's with me.
Good morning.
And it's your job. Tell them where we are.
We are at Yuma Proving Ground in Yuma, Arizona.
Yeah, just to the east of the big military base. How big?
It is almost bigger in landmass.
No, it is bigger.
It is bigger in landmass than the state of Rhode Island.
Marcus, you have it right?
Yeah,
Mark
absolutely.
Schauer's with me. Yeah. He's been helping out. You've had some great guests lined up today.
I know. We've got the best one for last for today. We've got Command Sergeant Major Jamison Nelson. He's going to be with us in just a couple minutes.
That's good. And what does the Command Sergeant Major do, just so can make sure I understand?
He's the top enlisted soldier here at YPG. He's the right hand for Colonel Poffenberger, the commander.
But now, everyone we've talked to so far has been civil service or civilian, which is most of the workforce out here.
YPG is overwhelmingly civilian. For its entire history, it's been majority civilian. But when conscription went away in the 1970s and the Army couldn't draft engineers anymore, stood to reason, we had to hire civilian engineers.
I guess I didn't know that.
If you remember Dunbar Norton, he came out to Yuma originally as executive officer here from 1971 to 1974, and that was insight he gave me.
Okay. And because engineering's a big part of the military. My son went to the Air Force Academy, and they're looking for engineers.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, too, is, if you consider test programs take a number of years to accomplish, you need continuity in the workforce. That's the reason YPG was always majority civilian. But back in the heyday, it was probably something like 60% uniform, 40% civilian.
And what was the heyday to you?
Oh, the 1950s and 1960s.
Not World War II.
We were around.
Right, that was the start of it.
Yeah, but it was, unlike today, back in World War II, it was primarily training troops to fight overseas. We were doing some testing, but the mission evolved as time went on.
All right, your Command Sergeant Major got here.
Yeah.
So, Mark, thank you so much.
So while we are switching around here, I just want to mention that if you want more information on the event this weekend, and you can go online to ypg2020.com and get all the interesting information in regards to the event this weekend.
Thank you, Veronica. Command Sergeant Major?
Morning, sir.
How morning,
are you?
Russ Clark.
Nice to meet you.
You go by Jamie?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah,
Jamie, and this is Veronica.
Nice to meet you.
She's helping.
Morning.
She's helping out. So you're in charge of this whole thing?
Well, no, not really.
Wait, that's not what I heard.
Well, I'm the background guy.
Yeah, you are.
So, that's kind of how it goes. So you have the commanding officer, and to break it down somewhat for, a civilian world, the commanding officer would be the CEO.
Right.
And the command sergeant major would be the COO, kind of making sure things are going on, that the commander wants.
And Jamie, where were you before you came here?
So I was in a very small unit called the Asymmetric Warfare Group on the Washington, D.C. area.
Right.
Yeah, kind of a special mission unit. So got to travel the world a lot. I spent 7 years there and then decided to compete to actually leave that unit and ended up here.
D.C. area to live is a little different than Yuma.
Yeah, when I first got here, all I heard about was, the traffic on 95 was terrible.
Yeah.
Really well. you should try the Baltimore, you know, the Baltimore Washington Expressway, BWI Expressway. And
right.
I live 30 miles away from the Pentagon. It takes me 3 hours to get to the Pentagon.
We get spoiled here.
Yeah.
We do. We think this is traffic.
Yeah, it slowed down significantly. You know, my wife and I, when we got here, we can drive anywhere we want and get there in no time. It's pretty nice.
So you coming from background, I mean, before this, you were traveling already, but YPG or Yuma Proving Grounds is a traveling position because you've got Alaska, you've got Panama, but you're still home more?
Yeah, a lot more.
Okay.
So I'd be gone. My last job, I was all over the world. Mostly the CENTCOM area, so spent a lot of time in North Africa, a lot of time in Iraq, Afghanistan, Lebanon, Jordan areas, so did a lot of work there.
And what did the work entail then?
So it's mostly advisory.
Advisory?
Yeah,
okay.
Advisory to both U.S. forces and foreign military.
All right, and now you've switched it to testing.
Yeah, and something I wasn't even aware of. You know, when the list comes out for sergeant majors, you know you're on the list. I knew I'd made the primary as an operational primary select for an operational brigade. So I told my wife, who's also in the Army, that, hey, I'm going to be a brigade sergeant major and I'm going to deploy, you know, unlike you don't want me to, but I'm going to operational brigade. And then when a year later, or actually it's a couple months later, about 3 months later, the list comes out and it tells you where you're going, and I saw YPG, and I immediately got on the internet and started Googling YPG.
Right.
I knew the free fall school, you know, because it's kind of the opposite side of what I did. I'm a special operations diver, mm-hmm. underwater guy, so I've always been around free fall guys, but I didn't know, and I knew the free fall school was here, but I had no clue anything else was here.
And your wife and family's all here now?
Yes. Yep. Yep. My wife actually worked at the free fall school, so.
Okay.
Got her a job there as a supply sergeant for the free fall school. So it worked out really well for us.
And I know when they built our indoor free fall, you know, the big fan.
Yeah, the wind tunnel.
That was the largest, one of the largest in the world at the time. I don't know if it still is.
So it's one of the most powerful. And from what they tell me, again, not an expert in the free fall world, it's one of the best. Because when it was done right. It was laid out perfect. And where you have problems with those is if they're just a little bit off, you kind of fly crooked or sideways. And this one, from what they tell me, is perfect.
They had levels.
It's the best. It is the best there is.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Have you been in it to test it?
You know, I've gone there. I've not flown in it.
No.
My wife went in it. Everybody wants me to do, you know.
Well, they're going to get pictures of it.
I'm just not interested in doing that. I've been to every school the Army has except for that school. If you'd have caught me 10 years ago, I'd have been all about it. But now, you know, I was told to go to the free fall, you know, open door.
Yeah.
Our commanding general is like, send your sergeant major to the free fall school. And, you know, it caught me a little late in the game. Just not interested in, because I tried for years and years and years to get to the school.
Really?
And then I kind of, it's once you're a diver or back, you know, years ago, once you were a diver, they held on to you. So you were either on a dive team or you're on a free fall team.
Okay.
So once you were a diver, that was it. You weren't going. They were keeping you as a diver because that's the hard one to get.
Now, why is it we don't think of Navy? Or, I mean, we think of Navy when we think of diving, not Army. But
yeah.
Army has its dive teams.
So they do. So, you know, in special operations, you know, in like the Green Berets, the ODAs,
okay,
they all have one dive team.
Right.
You know, now everyone's free fall qualified, but they still have one dive team, you know, per company. So one of the teams will be a dive team. And you are correct. The Navy still runs. Anything that has to do with water is run by the Navy. So the school that I went to, the Special Operations Combat Diver Course, is run by the Navy. It's all Navy regulations. It is an Army commanding officer with a Navy XO. And back when I went, which was, you know, over 20 years ago, it was Marine Corps, Air Force, Navy, and Army. So it was a joint school, and they've since kind of broke away. The Air Force has their own, the Marines have their own.
But they work in unison pretty much, don't they? When they operationally, don't the Special Forces work together?
They'll still work in their own teams,
okay,
but they'll fall under the same commands.
Okay.
Yeah.
Moving to YPG now. You've been out here for a year?
No, I'm coming up on two, actually.
Coming up on two.
Yeah, March 27th.
Have you seen every square mile of it so far?
Oh, no.
No.
No, it would take you... I don't think anyone's seen every square mile. I mean, from the air, absolutely.
Yeah.
From the air, I have. But there's so much land here. There's 1,309 square miles. So that's a lot of miles.
Yeah, it's amazing how big it is. And I'm one that hasn't even seen it all from the air.
Yeah.
Because you can't fly over it.
Oh, and you can drive down 95 and think nothing's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And you are mistaken. I'm sure you've heard in all the interviews, you know, Mr. Bracamonte that was here earlier, Ross Gwynn, all those guys will tell you that, you know, 100 to 150 tests every single day go on here. So there's testing all over the place, you know, and that's a lot of people ask us, why do we work 4 days a week? It takes a long time to get to some of our places to work.
And all that testing is done, civilian, civil service, and all that, but it goes under the Army's control.
Yes, the test center's control.
Okay.
This the YTC.
And that would be your venue. I mean, you know everything that's happening out here.
I would like to think so, but there's honestly, we follow the big programs.
Okay, but I mean, you know,
yes,
you know, what's operationally happening.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I know. And we go out and we visit them. I mean, there's some smaller tests, you know, that kind of fly below the radar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the guys, the Ross Gwynns and those guys, they have them, you know. They don't need any direction. They've done it. It's certainly not for me. So I'm kind of a one-off as far as being stationed here. Everyone here, like when I got this job and I found out it was developmental testing, everyone's engineers and scientists, I went to the CG that was stationed in Aberdeen. And I was like, sir, I'm just down the road. I'd like to have an office call before I got to Yuma.
Yeah.
And I flat out told him, hey, I am not an engineer. I am not. I've never been out of an operational unit in my life. I deploy. I'm an infantryman. I'm an Army Ranger. That's what I know. So maybe you picked the wrong guy. And
yeah.
he was like, actually, you're what we don't have. So when they are doing these developmental tests and they show you something, and then I look at it and I say, hey, if that vehicle rolls on its side and that door weighs 1,100 pounds, how do I get out? You know, I kind of think of things from a different perspective, and that's why me and the commander make such a great team, because he understands the acquisition process,
right.
And I understand the operational process. So us together, and as all great commanders, we bounce things off each other all day long. You know, he really listens to me and gets my buy-in on things.
So after 2 years, you think that not it was a good fit and that kind of leadership needs to continue?
Absolutely. So what I will say is sometimes the Army gives you what you need, not what you want. And this has been one of the best assignments I've ever had. I've learned more here. And I mean, I'm at 30 years in.
Okay.
So I originally joined the Marine Corps, or enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1985 as an infantryman. So I've been doing this since 1985, and this is probably my best assignment. Because every day I learn something,
right.
You know, and I get to look at different things. You know, I love it here. I do. Yuma was a big surprise, and the community is unbelievable.
And this facility, I know, is always testing and looking at the future, but the future is where the engineers, the scientists, and that's got to be exciting. And I don't know how involved you get into looking at the future. Armaments and future things, but that's, I'm sure, as an infantryman, you've got to be just ecstatic.
I'm deep in it because, I mean, yeah, you're kind of hitting head on, is because that stuff's important to me. So I tell everyone, I've spent 30 years picking up things and firing things and, you know, using American equipment and never put any thought into why our stuff always works. You know, I didn't care. You know, I was one of those guys, just give me my stuff, let me go, let me shoot it, let me do what I have to do. And then this background piece of why our stuff works and theirs doesn't. Because I have picked up a lot of foreign stuff, and you got about a 50-50 chance of that stuff actually working, because they're just mass producing it, stamping it out, sending it out, and if it works, it works. And, you know, if it doesn't work, pick up another one and try that one, where our stuff works every single time. You know, and, you know, what everyone will tell you, all the civilians, the contractors, we're all one team, and they understand that the stuff that they're giving to our soldiers is the best stuff in the world, and that's why it's tested here.
And with your operational background, looking at the stuff you're doing every day, it's got to be a different viewpoint, because you're looking from the standpoint of out in the field, and the stuff coming down that's new, I'm sure you said, I wish I had that 10 years ago.
So some of the stuff I think that Ross Gwynn was just talking about, you know, some of the aerial delivery systems, is like, that would have been a lot of weight off my back, mm-hmm. of me having to carry stuff in, when you can just fly that stuff to me, you know, and bring it right to me. That would have been nice, you know. So, but in the future, they'll have that. I mean, we made it work. We always did that, you know, as American, you know, soldiers and in the military, we'll make it work. But any help we can get, and we're getting a lot of it, and you're right. The artillery, I've never really touched a tank in my life or artillery rounds. I've told everyone I've been on the other side of them. I've watched them land. I've called them, but I've never fired them. So it's interesting to me. Very interesting.
And do you get hands on out there?
As much as I want.
So you've ridden in the tanks?
No, I, you know, just doesn't.
You're too big for a tank.
Yeah, I am.
Jamie.
So there's a lot of things that, you know, there's a lot of things that I wish I could do, and you know, like I said, I don't know. I've never been a tanker type person or an artillery person. I appreciate them. I understand what they do. It's just I'm a jump out of an airplane guy. Even as, you know, yes, I land fast, I come down fast, and I land hard.
But, yeah. The drones and the things that are newer and coming up that didn't exist 20 years ago. Do you see that they're vital? They're real vital. That they can be a big, big help.
Absolutely. So, you know, one, them being autonomous, you're not, you know, it's just an extension, you know, you're not sacrificing people, you know, when you're sending things out. It's like flying off a helicopter from a ship. It's an extension of the ship. It's safety. It's a safety net for that ship, and that's what that autonomous aircraft is. And the more advanced they get and the more information they can feed you, and the more information you have, the faster you can make decisions. You know, for that guy on the ground that can tap into that vehicle in the air and see what's going on before he has to go there, you know, so like one of the things we were doing right before I left Afghanistan is we were using them to look at the backside of walls before we had to go through the wall. So we'd fly little autonomous vehicles, you know, do an aerial recon, and then, you know, it's safety. It's all about safety.
Is that something you'd carry in a backpack? I mean, something that...
Oh, yeah.
On the ground, you'd be carrying
that. Yeah, one guy would carry a small micro UAS.
And just throw it up in the air and go behind a wall.
I mean, everyone's using them. They're in use all over the world. I mean, you can go in town and people use them for different things. And, I mean, your imagination of how you use these things is, you know, up to you.
Oh, yeah, that technology's exploded faster than we can regulate it.
Yeah, and it's all commercial off the shelf.
You know? One thing we've noticed is that everybody is here playing around, but with the mentality that this is a center of excellence. I think we've heard that over and over.
So for 9 years in a row, oh, you mean for the small UAS. For the class one and class two, yeah, for the smaller UAS, we are the center of excellence. We are the testing authority for those. So, you know, the bigger ones go somewhere else, but we have those here.
But Jamie, how can everybody have so much fun doing their job and still call it work?
Yeah.
Well, isn't that the point of finding a good job? You know, find a job that you don't consider work, right?
I haven't talked to anybody out here that doesn't have a smile on their face.
So when people
talk
ask
about
me, you know, I'm turning 53 and I'm still an infantryman, and they're like, why do you do it? I love it. You know,
yeah.
I love talking to younger soldiers and, you know, those people that pulled me aside. I love my job, you know.
Command Sergeant Major at a test center, you still call yourself an infantryman?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because that's, you know, regardless of what position I'm in, I mean, you are who you are.
Yeah.
And that's, I've done it since I was 17, and like I said, I'm getting ready to turn 50-something, so...
Yeah, and you're still engaged in it.
Absolutely.
And you think this is an extension of what you're doing.
Yes, this, to me, instead of talking to the soldiers, this is preparing them for the future. For the young 12, 13, 14-year-olds that aren't in the military yet, giving them the best stuff, I mean, that's my job.
Yeah.
My job is to make sure that, you know, they have what they need, either mentally, physically, or equipment-wise, to prepare them, you know, to meet our nation's needs. And that's what YPG does.
Amazing the artillery stuff they're doing out here. And I can't imagine being an infantryman and calling and saying, I want you to shoot some artillery right next to me.
Yeah, sometimes you got to you fire in the red zone. Yeah.
But that's
danger close.
That's something they're getting good at.
Very good. Yeah, and see, that's what separates us from a lot of countries too. We care about where we're shooting at. You know, collateral damage is important to us. Where, you know, most other countries, they just fire. You know, for us, being pinpoint accurate is, you know, if we want to shoot a building, we will shoot that building. You know, we will know what the collateral damage is.
And do it from there.
Yeah.
You, now that you've been out here, you recommend this to other people to come out and as a career?
So, yes. You mean for military or?
For both. Military, civilian, engineers?
I think engineer-wise, this is a great place. If you want to get involved and you want to get, you know, work for the government, I tell the contract, I don't care what you do on YPG, you are part of the military. Honestly, you are at the forefront of what we're going to do in 10 years. That's a piece of you. We had a gentleman retire probably last year that worked extensively on the Bradley for years and years and years. And I told him, you've done 40 years at YPG. You've worked the Bradley program all the way through. So know that when you retire and you watch a movie or you see a Bradley, that's you.
Yeah.
That's your legacy. You did that. No one might not, you know, no one knows it, but that's you. You made that Bradley. You know, there's an E6 or a staff sergeant with his crew in a Bradley, you know, somewhere in Europe right now, thanks to you. You know, thanks to you.
Now, you... Obviously, you're here now, and you're in your 50s mm-hmm. as an infantry. Is this the last stop for you?
I think so. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. It is. It's going to be the last one. Once you get to a certain point, the Army kind of tells you what you're doing. You really you don't have choices. Like when I took this job, I was I don't know if I want to go to Yuma.
Right.
And luckily, the command sergeant major that was out here, Chris Prosser, he called me as soon as the minute the list came out. He called me. He said, what do you think? And I said, I don't think so, you know. And he started talking to me, and I was like, you know what? Yeah, I think maybe I will. So they need to stay on this trend of sending, an operational guy like me. Last Sergeant Major Prosser was a tanker, great fit for here.
Right.
You know, and there hasn't been too many operational guys here as Sergeant Majors, and I think they need to continue that.
It's been good. Also, would you recommend military?
So...
And of course, military, you're not going to go to a place like...
Right. In the beginning, when I first got here and I really didn't understand developmental testing,
yeah.
I was like, why don't we have soldiers testing this? Why don't we have this? And once again, talking to the commander, you get soldiers involved early on developmental testing, they form opinions on things before it becomes an actual system or a program of record. So if I'm fielding... you know, a new phone, and we haven't worked all the bugs out of it yet, right? And I give it to you, and you're like, oh, this phone's junk. Well, we're still working on it, but that opinion kind of, they carry that opinion. So until we get it, and we're developmental, and we do ATAC, Army Test and Evaluation mm-hmm. Command, has operational testing. So once we get it to a certain point, then we hand it over to them, you know, and they test it with soldiers. That's the operational test that goes on after the developmental test. So then it goes to the hands of the soldiers. They look at it, they drive it, they fire it, or whatever, and it goes from there. Then we make a few more tweaks.
How open to input is Yuma Proving Ground from engineers, non-engineers, command? If you see something in a test and you say, hey, I like what you're doing, but what if you tried this? I mean, are they open to things?
So we just test. We okay. collect the data. You bring your product to us, you're managing your product, and we give you the test data. So if we say, hey, this is where your test is at, then it's up to the program manager or whoever's bringing the item to us to make those decisions. Now, most of those are military. The program manager, a lot of them are military. It's about half and half. Yeah, they listen, but, you know, depending on what the system is, I'm probably not the right guy to tell you how to run your system. You know what I mean? I can tell you some other things, but that's probably not my wheelhouse.
Yeah. And where's home for you? Or do you even have one after 30 years in the military?
Yeah, you don't. My home is Yuma, Arizona right now. So everywhere I move, which has been probably 25 times, you know, in the military.
That's home.
That's it. Yeah, I left when I was 17, and I haven't gone back. So.
And children?
So, yes, I had 5 total. So okay. I've been married twice. So I have 3 older children, you know, ages 31 to 26.
Military?
My youngest son's in the Air Force still, just redeployed for his 5th time.
Right.
He's in Air Force Special Operations, and my oldest son was an infantry officer. And he just did a short stint and got out after his commitment.
Okay.
And then my daughter, when somebody asked her, she's like, I think my dad and my brothers have it covered on top.
We need diversities in the family.
Yeah, I'm going to be a baking and pastry chef. That's my life.
Bakery, the pastry chef.
Yeah.
That's it.
And I have 2 younger children with my current wife now.
And you would recommend military or try to steer them away?
I love it.
Me too.
Yeah, I love it. Now, I would recommend understanding what you want to do. Don't just enlist in the military until you know what you want
to
do.
Choose a profession in the military.
Absolutely. It's like, I have a big thing about college with my kids. Kids out of high school immediately go to college, but they're picking a career field, and they don't really know what they want to do in life.
Yeah. 1 minute? We got 1 minute. I'm going to kick you out. I know.
No problem.
Saturday.
I got places.
You're going to be around Saturday.
I am.
Okay, big celebration. I'm looking forward to it. I know this entire base.
Don't underestimate the size of it. It's going to be big.
I'm going to be here.
Okay.
We'll hold you to it.
Yep.
Jamie, thank you so much for coming.
That's
in. Thank you
pleasure.
For what you do and your service to the country.
Anytime.
AM 560 KBLU. This is Russ Clark. Thanks.